This is BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore. In this episode, we're going to talk about designing mechanical systems for resilient and sustainable healthcare. My guest in this episode is Kevin McNutt, who is an engineering planning principal at BSA. Kevin graduated from Olivet Nazarene University with a BS in mechanical engineering and has been a licensed PE for nearly 20 years. He spent his entire career at BSA and was previously the director of engineering. Welcome back to the show, Kevin.
Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Well, it's always nice to talk to you. And I wanted to have you on because you're coming out with an article soon called The Art of Balance, about designing mechanical systems for resilient and sustainable healthcare. And I thought it was great. And I just wanted to have you on the show to talk about it a little bit. So when did you realize that engineering for healthcare wasn't just technical, but it's also an art?
Sure. So I've been in the industry a long time, so I don't think I remember the exact moment, obviously. Right. It was probably my first or second client meeting. So the interesting thing about this industry is you start usually behind a computer, learning how to design, learning all of the technical parts of the job, coordinating with other disciplines. And then as the years go by, then you start to get engaged more so in client meetings, right?
Sure.
So that first client meeting, you got an architect, a contractor, the owner, other engineers, and everyone has a different opinion, right? And so kind of that trigger just flips that, oh no, this is not just what I know and what everybody knows. We have to all kind of come together and build this thing together. So design is definitely subjective, and it's going to take a lot of work to kind of build that team and build that consensus. But that's one part.
That's really cool. I mean, I like what you say when you're talking about it. Design is a, how did you just phrase that? It slipped my mind.
Definitely subjective.
Subjective. You know, it's like looking at a piece of art, yeah, or listening to music, or yeah, watching a TV show or something. Do you remember the moment in a project where you said, oh, this is going to be interesting?
Well, not that specific first moment,
right,
the light bulb went off. But yeah, I've had a lot of those through my career. And I think the important thing is you're going to have conflict. Some's good, some is bad. But I think you just really need to keep that vision on why you're there, what the end goal of that project is, the patients you're going to help, the clinical staff, the facility staff, and just keeping their goals in mind.
So can you walk the listeners and me through like that patient tower scenario? What made it so unusual from an engineering perspective?
Yeah, so a few things. One, the site was never planned out for more expansion. You know, they had a master plan, they completed that master plan, and they thought they were done on that site. It was pretty much fully built, I would say. They had parking issues, had circulation issues as it was. And now we're going to add another, I think it was 120,000 square foot, which obviously more parking, more utility. So as you're diving into existing engineering systems, you really have to untangle all those systems, figure out their existing issues, and how you're going to solve those while also expanding to the campus. And we always say, as soon as you touch a system, you own it. So even though, you know,
you didn't do it originally,
no part of the original project, I own those systems now, so I have to fix those problems and I have to make sure I don't create any new ones.
I was going to say there's a lot of looking back, but also you're trying to look ahead, right?
Oh, yeah.
And make sure.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Which is the fun part. That's the part I love. It's that front end part that really, really drives me. A few other things. One, again, the systems and the distribution, really have to untangle all that. And then we're building a new campus and the site utilities are moving. We have to get new utilities from point A to point B through an existing operating hospital. So really untangling all of that is complex. And again, the fun part. And probably the most interesting piece of it was structurally, is kind of odd to say, but we were parking this new addition in between two existing buildings and actually hanging part of our new addition over existing roof, right? So all the structure to hang that all the way, you know, four floors down is pretty immense.
Right.
And so we have to coordinate around that mechanically with, we're the largest people above ceiling with the ductwork. Really just talking through how we're going to do that with duct locations, piping locations, and distribution to make it all work.
So was there ever a moment where you thought the solution wouldn't be possible? No?
No, not with the team we had. I mean, A-plus team, really, of contractors on board already, the design team, the owner, just really collaborative and pushing each other. It was a great team. So not only collaborative, but creative and challenging each other in a healthy way
mm-hmm.
to look outside the box and try to figure out new solutions. Really, I think the moral of the story is surround yourself with a strong team.
Yeah, you kind of hear that in all walks of life, right? Like surround yourself by the smartest people.
Yeah, definitely.
What were the biggest misconceptions that stakeholders had going into a project like that?
So for that particular project, I wouldn't really say misconceptions. That's an educated client and contractor with a large amount of construction experience. So not really misconceptions, but definitely an alignment period to make sure we're all on the same page. And a few of those things are we had potential upcoming code changes that were hovering over us. So do we design to those maybe being...
And did you know what they were going to be?
Not all of them, no. So some
were, now you're guessing.
Yeah, correct. So like we knew the building code was going to change potentially.
Okay.
Hasn't been adopted still, but it's hanging out there.
Right.
That one's pretty clean. Energy code is a huge one.
Right.
And they may not adopt it. They may. And that has a huge impact on design, especially for mechanical systems. So it's fun. You try to balance that first cost with sustainability, which obviously you have to meet code.
Right.
So there's a lot of things competing against one another. Another couple of things were addressing the existing system issues, which mm-hmm. I already talked about. Mm-hmm. It's ours now. So we have to make sure that we fix all of those. Obviously, that's important for the project. And then balancing the status quo with new technology. So that campus is 10 plus years old for all their building.
Right.
We're building this new building and what new technology is out there
right.
that we can implement, but not change the entire campus to balance first cost, because really push that client forward.
I would imagine just like everything else in life, it's changed quite a bit in 10 years technology wise.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's exponential growth in the technology field. So,
okay. If you had to predict, are future hospitals going to lean more towards resiliency, sustainability, or is there a sweet spot that's shifting?
Great question. And I think it's actually different depending on the client and their size and their staff capability. I think declining revenue for healthcare, you see their overhead, their margin is decreasing rapidly.
Yeah.
And cost pressures, AI capability, push for decarbonization, coupled with all the utility grid issues that we're hearing, especially with all the data center booms. I think that suggests sustainability to lower your energy profile and to set you up for the long term with rising, you know, utility costs. On the flip side, there's a push to downsize, the dreaded do more with less. So you see a lot fewer staff at a lot of these hospitals. So I think that, along with the knowledge retiring and leaving the field.
Oh, good point.
Suggests simplicity and resiliency,
yeah.
More so over sustainability and complexity.
Do healthcare systems better understand resiliency now, or are we still fighting that'll never happen again sort of mindset?
Sure. So all the people I talk to in the industry, really, it's not if, it's when the next thing's going to happen, whether that be a natural disaster, floods. We had a huge flood here in Central Indiana
you
know, a decade ago that wiped out a hospital that we helped rebuild.
Yeah.
Pandemic. Big one,
right.
Obviously. So we're designing a lot of pandemic systems and resiliency into projects. So that's big. So I think they fully embrace the resiliency design concerns and we're talking about it a lot more. Hospitals are mission critical, right? So it has to run. So they're definitely viewing it from the if not when standpoint. And I think they realize that the time to prepare for that is now.
Right.
Not only on new buildings, but also existing. But again, the cost pressures that they're facing, we can't just go in and change an entire hospital campus to address these issues. So they're usually biting them off in smaller chunks with the revenue that you have.
When they can. And so I want to go back to something you mentioned, the labor shortages. And in the article, you mentioned tariffs too. What's the constraint people underestimate most right now?
I think it's labor by far. I think tariffs have an impact, but I think labor by far is a much bigger impact. So regional pressures, for one, due to other work here in Central Indiana, we have battery plants, the life science district just north of the city,
yep.
A lot of data centers, and by the way, the largest healthcare project in the country right now in downtown that we are also working on. So that plays a huge role in the available labor market. Retiring workforce that we've talked about a little bit. There's a lot of people in the trades that are upper 60s, 70s, still working and hanging on, but you know, their retirement is imminent. And then I think one of the biggest problems that I think is now starting to get addressed in the conversations I've talked to is that lull that we really had in recruitment to get people in the trades and facilities.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And architecture. There was that big push that, you know, all the parents want to send their kids to college, and that was the only option.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people out there with degrees that could be welders, could be pipe fitters, you know, could be carpenters that make a really good living. And we need all those trades. And I think they recognize that, and they're making a lot harder push to get out to the high school, showcase all the opportunities in the construction world. I think it's starting to come back, but there's definitely that gap, I think, between that retiring.
That's what I was going to say.
And the new generation.
It definitely seems like there's a gap. And I know my wife's a teacher, and at the school she's at in the high school, they have now created like programs. Hey, you already know that you want to work in the trades. Let's get you into some of those classes while you're in high school and get you on a route to go through that process. If college is not appealing to you, we're not going to just force you to take all these tests and requirements to go that way. You can go ahead and do that. And I hear her and others talk a lot about, like, I've got kids that are going to be awesome at doing X, Y, and Z. Just because they don't love English or psychology doesn't mean that they're not going to find their spot. And I think that's probably the better approach, and it wouldn't certainly help infill what's missing. But then there's that middle section, you know, who's going to be able to pass down to that younger generation once they get out into the workforce.
Yeah, so that's a huge problem. And I think that is due to a lot of factors, but I think one of the biggest ones was the housing market crisis that we had. There's a lot of people that got out of industries during that time to find a job just so they could pay the bills. We had a lot of architects and engineers completely leave architecture and engineering and go do something else because they weren't jobs. So they never came back.
Interesting.
So there is that generational gap in the middle between the generation just now in school and the retiring generation to pass that knowledge.
Yeah. Kind of in the middle, like us.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's shift back to prefabrication and modular strategies play a big role in one of the examples that you gave in your article. How do you see the role of prefab evolving?
So it's definitely been adopted regionally by different trades, different owners and contractors, their foundational beliefs, whether they believe in the benefits of prefabrication. I've seen varying aspects all across the country where we work. I think we'll see prefab increase exponentially in the next 10 years from where we're at currently. And it's going to be more than just pump skids or restroom pods as the downtown hospital project. And I think AI and technology is going to expedite that. I think the labor issues will help expedite that. Less people on a job site, more people in a factory or a warehouse cranking out all these prefab modules to then ship to site and install.
It's interesting.
Increases speed to market. It's a means of cost control with constantly rising prices, outpacing inflation in the construction world.
Goes back to the old saying, time is money. The longer you're on the job site, the more it adds up.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a good project downtown that we prefabricated the MEP utilities inside the labs. The duct, the piping, gases, cable tray, bus duct for electrical. It was full MEP. And they fabricated, I believe, 60 of these modules on site. And then shipped them to site. So they went from 0% MEP overhead to like 60% MEP overhead.
Wow.
Inside of a month. Much safer. You know, no one's working over their head. They're all working down at ground level.
Right.
So not only cost savings, but again, speed to market, worker comfort, ergonomic issues. It was
interesting.
A success. So I think we'll see a lot more of that.
So a little bit ago, you were mentioning cost and budget playing such a factor. What's one cost-saving measure that sounds good, but often hurts a project long-term?
I think I'd say decarbonization done wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, I think decarbonization.
I hear it so much.
And I think it's a great idea, but if you have to do it right. And I just had a conversation last week about this, actually. So someone threw out the idea, well, should we have an electrified building? What about electric heat or electric boilers? And that just, you know, gives me pause because it'll be lower first cost to do electric heat versus a natural gas boiler and water heater, which makes sense. But long term, you're going to pay for that because the electric utilities are much higher than gas prices currently. So in that switch from fossil fuel to electrification, you have to do it smart and with the right equipment at higher efficiencies than just a pretty flat out switch to just electric heat that you typically see.
So you raise an important point about veteran facility professionals retiring. What worries you the most about that gap?
I think it's the historical knowledge and the immense amount of lessons learned that, they've picked up over the years at their facilities that are just walking out the door.
Right.
There's no way to replace that. I mean, you could hire four people to replace that one person, but the historical knowledge piece isn't there. So I think not being able to pass down that historical knowledge is my biggest concern. And as we talked a little bit about the high school, the different options, there's so many career options now.
There are.
And it's really difficult to recruit people to certain trades or be an architect or be an engineer.
Right.
There's so much competition.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're fighting that. And this the generational employment gaps that we talked about already. When I did the leadership development program, what I presented was the gap in how the AE industry is going to grow over the next 10 years. And we're at like 10% of that pace to hire enough architects and engineers and construction workers to keep up with the projected growth. So that's a huge gap that we need to figure out. And my hope is that we can really figure out and adopt this AI that everyone's talking about and not need all those people, but work smarter.
Right.
And automate as much as we can so we can do more with the same amount of people. I think that's how we're going to tackle the challenge.
I feel like we talk about AI on this podcast all the time in different capacities. And I agree with you. I think there's so much that's going to be able to be done by tapping into it. The one thing that you just mentioned, though, that has always given me a little pause is the historical knowledge. So how do I replace using AI, you know, like client background, like you taking somebody's human brain that has all this subtle context, you know, whether it's in your personal life with your family, background situations, like how many times do you find yourself in a conversation with somebody like, well, there's a little more to the story than just that. You can get an answer, but there's so much more nuance to it. So I agree with you from the standpoint that I think AI is going to be able to help a lot in certain situations, but it is still important to have that mentorship capacity or that mentorship piece that people are transferring down some of that just inherent knowledge that's not found inside of an AI machine or an LLM, but I digress.
Well, you hear a lot, if you read the news on AI, there's a lot of CEOs out there, or even Elon Musk, saying that it's going to take everybody's job. I'm not on that boat.
I don't think so either, but
I mean, I think it's going to enable us to do our jobs better and faster and with more purpose. I don't think it's going to replace us. I was just talking to this on the job site yesterday. How is AI going to install that? And pointing at something in the wall.
It can't install it. It can do so much, but it can't replace some of that thinking that we were just talking about, and certainly none of the physical stuff, unless we're using robots. And we're putting the AI in the robots, which is probably going to happen too, or it already is being worked on. Who knows?
I guess time is up. I think it's going to enable us to work smarter and that humans will still be involved. That's my hope.
Yes, mine too. And we'll choose to be hopeful about it. So your article makes it clear silos are over. What does true collaboration look like on a project team?
So I think it's a few things. One, I think it's vision casting with all the stakeholders in the room. I don't think you can just have an architect, an engineer, and a client. I think you need clinical representation. You need contractors and people are going to use the building, maybe even patients for healthcare. I think everyone has to have common goals in the end. And maybe engineering has two of the seven goals that we're a part of.
Right.
But I think we need to develop the vision for this project, facility, whatever we're talking about collectively. The silos.
And a full and comprehensive one where everybody's kind of got a seat at the table.
One, I think if you look at it like a stool, I think they need to prop up each other.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Not one vision tears down another one. They have to all be supportive of each other.
That's a good analogy.
I think you need to be comfortable stepping outside your normal comfort zone well, right? So you're going to be challenged. I think you have to adopt the yes if mentality and not the no because.
Ooh, right? Like that shift.
So like I'm going to have an architect, I'm going to have an owner, I'm going to have a contractor challenge me on why that's the best system or could you locate it here because it makes sense for the clinical staff to have this space or whatever the case may be.
Right.
I think you have to view it positively and not, I can't do that because it would do this,
mm-hmm.
but maybe open your eyes a little bit and accept the challenge and say, yeah, we can make that work, but it may take these few other things. Is that okay? And really have that conversation and not be so rigid.
Well, I like the yes if, because you just stated it, but it's like, yes, we could do that if we move this or if we, you know, and it comes off a lot different in terms of a partnership and a conversation.
Oh, you're way more collaborative.
Right.
The yes if approach. And then another thing that kind of expands on that a little bit, I think not only stepping outside of your comfort zone, but really embracing ideation and options. I know engineers and options don't go together well, right? They like to give me the floor plan, right, and then I'll do this, and then she'll do this, and then he'll do this, and then we'll issue the job.
And it's a bunch of and then statements.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They're robots, right? So I don't think you can operate that like that in a collaborative environment. You have to accept the challenge and say, all right, that's an option that I don't think will work because of these things, but let's run it to ground. And then with that yes if mentality, what would it take to make that work?
Yeah.
And you don't have to fully design a hospital three times to get to the right option.
Sure.
But you have to go through a certain amount of the paces to say, here's what this means. Here are the pros and the cons for this option. Here are the pros and the cons for this next option.
Right.
And just be open and talk about it.
So how do you help clients look beyond the immediate bottom line, kind of circling back to some of the costs and budgetary concerns?
In addition to being open and honest and discussing all those issues and options that we talked about, life cycle costing is a great tool that we use to look at first cost versus, you know, life of that system,
mm-hmm.
not only operating costs, but maintenance costs, replacement costs. And so you get the full picture, not just the day one picture. There's a stat out there, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but if you take the life of a hospital, 100 years, let's say, right, the cost of the actual building the hospital is like 1%
of its entire life cycle.
So you got to pay doctors, pay nursing staff, products, disposables, all of that adds up to 99% of the life cycle. So if you're looking
in
that silo of first cost only, I think you're missing the bigger picture. And I think in presenting the technical piece of engineering, that art comes back to it of you can't just listen to a client, ask them, what do you want, and then do that.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you have to raise healthy conflict and challenge them to say, I hear you say you want this system. Well, why?
Mm-hmm.
Because this other system over here we think could be a better option. I think you just have to be that trusted partner and not just march along to what status quo has been, but really bring up new ideas, new innovation, and challenge that respectfully, obviously.
That's why you're at the table. I want to hit you with some rapid fire questions. So this is a new kind of little segment I'm trying.
Right.
Yeah. And so don't think too long. Just, you know, whatever pops into your head.
Sure. Okay.
So sustainability or resiliency, what's harder to explain to clients?
I think sustainability.
Okay. Because
I think it means something different to everybody. You know, some people think it's energy savings. Some people think it's reduction of waste.
Yep.
Some people think it's LEED. Just, we're going to do LEED, so we're going to be sustainable. And it's not just that. You can't discuss it in silos. It's holistic.
You are definitely, so Drew was on our last episode and he answered the same question just like you did.
Okay.
And you're an architect and an engineer. Right. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to ask you, is just to kind of see what it was.
Kindred spirits.
Yes. So the engineering innovation you wish everyone understood.
Well, it's evolving so rapidly. I think I'll go more broad and say AI and technology. So
yeah.
That changes so rapidly.
Well, it's on everybody's minds, and it ventures between understanding it partly and a buzzword.
Definitely. Let me pull one example out
okay.
of that. I'll say smart rooms.
Okay.
It's like a patient room that has the ability to control everything from your phone, as an example. Shades, TV, temperature, all of that. That's not easy. That's not a bolt-on solution at the end of a project or during construction. It involves a lot of coordination and discussion up front. And so I think just getting that understanding of how complex that it sounds,
mm-hmm.
but it's just time and conversation to get to the right solution. And it needs to be planned for.
That's a good answer. Most underrated MEP component in a hospital.
Ooh. My mind goes to, and I'm going to cheat a little bit. It's not necessarily a component, but a system.
Fine.
What is it? An electrical distribution system.
Okay.
Which is strange coming from a mechanical engineer. But I can't tell you how many times in my career I've heard people say, well, we need to hire a good mechanical engineer because their systems are complex. But electrical systems just need to work. Like, they just expect it to work.
Right.
But if there's a single point of failure and you lose
power, the electrical side.
It can be electrical, and then the whole hospital's scrambling, or they're moving patients, or...
That's a really good point.
You're getting some bad calls that day.
Yeah.
And so I think, yeah, that's underrated, the electrical distribution system.
Good answer. The one thing people get wrong about mechanical engineers, such as yourself.
Ah, boy, we are all very different. I know so many engineers that want to just sit by their desk or sit at their desk, run calculations, make spreadsheets, work independently in their own little silo,
right?
Not have anything change. That's not me. I would rather be out in the field talking to a contractor, a client, asking them what their problems are and helping them solve it. Hands-on right there with them, not by myself.
You gain a lot of experience doing it that way, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's one thing to see it on paper, on a screen or whatever, and then going out to a site and actually seeing it and how it's being built, you know.
Exponential growth by interacting with others.
For sure.
And being out in the field, yeah. And I'll end it with, I've actually been told I'm not an engineer before.
Really?
Yeah. So, like, you don't talk like an engineer.
What do they think you are, then?
I don't know. Yeah, I think they're probably just more projecting what their typical engineering.
Like a prototype.
Like, he's not quiet.
Right.
And he talks a lot sometimes.
Okay, last one. If engineering were truly an art, what's the medium? So like a painting, a song, a movie, what's its art?
That's a great question. I'm going to go song. Yeah, because there's so many individual parts that have to come together to make it lasting.
I like that.
And dare I say beautiful in its own way.
I love it. Well, thanks for coming on the show. This has been great. I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
I'd like to thank Kevin again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with him on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA or our engineering discipline, we encourage you to visit our website at bsadesign.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And be sure to check out BSA on social media, including LinkedIn and YouTube. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.